This is Again for the First Time with your host, Darren Redmond.
Hello, everybody. This is Darren Redmond with the Again for the First Time podcast. And I've been wanting to talk to this individual for a long, long time. He does yeoman's work. He's not afraid to shake things up, and he doesn't do it just to get clicks or just to get followers. He does it from a place of caring. If you've seen X or Twitter or some of the other places, you know him as T-Wolf. You know, Tom Wolf is an advocate for life, and he's a person who doesn't pull any punches. I am enthralled in what he does. He's a recovery advocate, formerly homeless. He's a director of the West Coast Initiatives for the Foundation for Drug Policy Solutions. And he comes from a place of, hey, listen, here's what I think. Let me hear what you think, but don't be afraid when I push back on you, because I may, all for the betterment of society. Tom Wolf, thank you for being with me today.
Well, thank you, Darren. It's great to be here. Finally, to be next to you. It's been a while. So
yes, it has. And I appreciate that very much. So I'm going to start at a very weird place, because you've been in recovery, you do what you do now, and we're right at the holidays. And I know, because we both get the phone calls, I kicked my significant other out. My son and my daughter out on the street, but I want them home for the holiday. Grandma's getting older. Yes, no, maybe so. What is your thought process at that? It's not an easy answer, is it?
It's really not an easy answer, and it's a good question. It's a tough question, and the answer really depends on the relationship that you still have with that individual that you put out of the house. Mm-hmm. Drug use or no? Mm-hmm. What's the status of that relationship that you have? Also, what's the status of the individual who you put out of the house that's using drugs, in regards to, are they at a state where, you know, if they come over, you know, because of the desperation of addiction, it's going to be all about, you know, I need money, or some type of manipulation, or something worse? Or is it going to be more like, you know, this is an opportunity for you to reduce some stigma and shed some shame and come home and be part of the family for a day? Mm-hmm. You know, it's hard, because look, with my family, I became homeless basically because I made the choice to leave my home because of my addiction. But the rest of my family kind of put me out, and that they started practicing what they call separation with love. Right. And that's because while I was in my addiction, you know, I would manipulate them for money. I stole money from both of my elderly parents. I borrowed thousands of dollars from my siblings. I stole money from my wife when I was using. These are all facts. Okay. Mm-hmm. And you know, and that's because drugs aren't free. They're not free. It costs money. It costs a lot of money to use drugs, folks, and to be addicted to them. So, you know, it's hard, because at the end of the day, what I learned in recovery is that those around me that loved me also had to practice a certain level of self-care for them, for their own sanity. Mm-hmm. My wife, you know, put a restraining order on me and put me out of the house for her own sanity and for my kids' safety, you know. So I understand that now. I didn't understand it back then, but I understand it now, that I would have probably done the same thing, because addiction affects more than just the individual who's using. It affects your whole family, your friend group, your entire community. And so we have to acknowledge that, and acknowledge that there's also trauma that's being experienced by other people that are involved in your life, and that's valid.
I'm sure.
So there's really no easy answer, Darren. It really depends on each situation. But, you know, you want to welcome them home for the holidays, because it's a time of love and forgiveness and gratitude and all of those things. But if that person's also very, very sick, or you feel like that you're putting yourself in a difficult position or your family in a difficult position, you really need to consider that.
How about, let's flip it for a second. The person went through recovery. And how do you hit, what advice you give for handling the holidays, whether it's booze or, you know, pills or whatever.
Yeah.
What advice may you give?
That's another great question. So it's like, you got to take it slow. Mm-hmm. I think I was still in rehab. And I hadn't spoken to my wife in about a year, and my kids and longer than that. But I was sober. I was about 5 months sober by the time Thanksgiving, Christmas rolled around. I remember my brother invited me to his house, so I was able to take a pass from rehab and go there. And it was weird because everyone was happy that I was there. Everyone was happy that I was sober at that moment.
Mm-hmm.
But I also felt out of place, and there was definitely a trust gap that was there from the things that I had done. But at the end of the day, I was glad that I had made that connection. Mm-hmm. Because it gave me hope, and it gave me really a chance to feel normal. And that's a big thing, is that, you get desensitized, there's a disconnect when you become homeless. There's a disconnect when you use drugs and you become isolated. It's part of the actual disease itself.
Mm-hmm.
So it was nice to kind of reconnect and kind of feel normal again. And that really helped me a lot.
To kind of give me
some hope. Part of recovery is also making amends. Since I got sober, I've worked really hard to make, financial amends to people where I can, right?
Sure.
And not everybody's responded to that, and I have to accept that. That's part of the deal,
Right.
But most people have. And mm-hmm. I hosted Thanksgiving this year.
I saw that. That was beautiful.
I had 15 people over to my house. We made a turkey and the whole bit. And, that was just not an option 4 years ago, like a year into my recovery. It just wasn't there yet,
Right.
So you have to take it slow. You have to give it time. You don't have to fix everything all at once.
Mm-hmm.
When you get sober, it's like everybody wants to rush to undo the damage that they did. You didn't do the damage overnight, so you can't fix it overnight either.
Right.
So it really requires patience and fortitude. You have to keep working on yourself.
Mm-hmm.
Whatever program you're using to help you stay sober, and try to rebuild that trust slowly over time, but also, rebuild the confidence in yourself that, I got this, I'm okay. Regardless of what people think, I'm going to go out one thing and try to maintain and live this lifestyle in recovery.
Mm-hmm.
Hope. It takes a lot of hope.
Oh, sure.
That people will respond to that.
This seems like a good time to, if we can maybe step back for a minute, for those out there who don't really know your story, if you can share quickly whatever you'd like to share about your story, because it really is that story that happens and people don't even know what happens, does it?
No, so I'm a regular guy. I'm not anyone special. I had a decent middle-class upbringing, married with two kids, homeowner. All those things. I had a job with the city and county of San Francisco. Mm-hmm. As a child support officer. I used to go after dads that didn't pay their child support. That was my job. And in early 2015, I had broken my foot and I had to have surgery on my foot. And they had to set my foot and stick two titanium screws in there. And then they sent me home with a 30-day supply of 10 milligram oxycodone for the pain.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't use them as directed. There's no other way to say it. one pill wasn't cutting it every 4 to 6 hours, so then it became two pills. But I still remember that when I took three pills, the 30 milligram, that was kind of like the threshold for me.
Mm-hmm.
I kind of jumped this line into this euphoria where I was basically high as a kite. All my problems melted away. The pain was gone. Any marital problems, financial problems, all those things went away for about 3 to 4 hours. And so I wanted to keep it at that level. So I continued to use more than I was prescribed. And so, of course, my prescription, after about 10 days, 2 weeks, I'm running out.
Mm-hmm.
And I called my doctor to try to get more. I couldn't. So I actually tried to taper off. I went into withdrawal. And I wanted to keep that feeling going. So I actually Googled it up. Where can I buy pills on the street in San Francisco? It took me to YouTube. Mm-hmm. Showed some places in the Tenderloin where I could buy, and one of them was called Pill Hill.
Yeah.
Of Golden Gate and Leavenworth in San Francisco. I went there, and sure enough, there were five or six guys. Now, mind you, this was in 2015,
mm-hmm.
when you could buy oxycodone on the street. You can no longer purchase it on the street. It's all fentanyl now.
It's all fentanyl.
Yeah. There's not even heroin anymore out here. Out here in San Francisco, it's all fent. So yeah, there were five or six guys selling pills, and I ended up, you know, finding kind of one main guy. He was a veteran. He used to get two different scripts from the VA. He'd get one for 80 milligram oxycodone and one for 30 milligram morphine. And I used to buy a whole bunch of his supply from him, and I used it. And over the next year and a half or so, my addiction increased or grew to where I was taking 560 milligrams a day just to stay well, right?
Let me stop you there, just to kind of tie in to what we, as you proceed. When do you stop chasing the high and start chasing the I don't want to get dope sick?
When I was up there around 400 or 500 milligrams already.
Wow.
There was no more. I mean, I was still getting high off of it, but it was like I was really, really afraid of getting dope sick, because when I would try to back off of it, the withdrawals would kick in, and they were just fucking terrible, Darren. I mean,
People
that know, they know. You know, if you know, you know.
No, but I'll tell you, hearing stories like that and what we do and whatever, it's like today, and not talking out of school, I had some, you know, precancerous stuff done here. And the guy says, do you want some pain meds? I was like, nope. because of this, I played college football, and trust me, I know from what you talk. That's all I'm going to say. You know, that's all I'll say. But yeah, it's scary and it's quick. And your story, when you made the jump, for those of you that's on YouTube, please search it out. When you made the jump from oxy to heroin because it was cheaper, tell, if you don't mind, if you can share that story.
Yeah. So, you know, I'm buying 80 milligram pills from this guy on the street, $30 a pop. I'm taking seven a day. That's $210 a day times 7 days a week. So yeah, I dropped like 100K on drugs, on pills on the street. Mm-hmm. And it became no longer economically feasible. Basically, my wife found out what was happening. I mean, she knew, but there's a lot of denial in addiction.
Of course.
She knew, but then when she figured out, like, oh wow, the house is in foreclosure. Oh shit. Right. And that's how she found out, is that the house was in foreclosure because I'd stopped paying the mortgage to buy dope. Mm-hmm. She cut me off from the money. And I still remember going down to the Tenderloin that day with $30 in my pocket. And I was like, that's only enough for one pill. That's not going to cut it. So I walked down a block to Golden Gate and Hyde, and I bought an eighth of a gram. I bought a couple of dimes of heroin instead. And I'm diabetic, so I've got needles at home. I went back on YouTube, found one of those harm reduction videos on how to shoot up safely. And I proceeded to become an intravenous drug user. And that's when my life really spiraled out of control too. I mean, it was already out of control because I was bankrupt. Right. But that, you know, it's when I switched to heroin that I lost my job. It's when I switched to heroin that I started crashing the car. It's when I switched to heroin that I would be driving to the Tenderloin at 2 o'clock in the morning to score dope and falling asleep at the wheel on the way into the city, you know, things like that would happen. With when it spiraled into heroin, it was, you know, I still remember before I lost my job, I was bringing three pre-mixed syringes of heroin to work with me every day.
Gotcha.
And then going into the bathroom on my lunch break and shooting up. And then going back to my desk and passing out. I mean, those are the kinds of things where you no longer can function, even though I wasn't functioning well. I was using all of my money to buy drugs when I was on pills. But the functioning even went down even further with street heroin, of course. And then, you know, I eventually became homeless because my wife, you know, long story short is I stole some money from my wife, took the car, went down to the Tenderloin one day and didn't go home for 11 days. I did an 11-day bender out there. And the police found me and they told me to just go home because my wife had filed the missing persons report. I show up at the door. She's waiting for me with a packed bag saying, I got you a bed at a treatment center. You can either go to treatment or you can get out. And at that moment, I was dope sick.
Right.
So I left. I made the choice. I chose addiction over my family. And that's the thing that people that maybe don't understand addiction don't get. That the disease of addiction is so strong, you will choose it over your own wife and kids 10 times out of 10.
Mm-hmm.
For some people, for most people, really, to continue that addiction. And that took me to the street, where I ended up becoming homeless. I lived on the streets of San Francisco in the Tenderloin for 6 months, from January to June of 2018. I was using heroin, fentanyl towards the end of my time on the street. I was holding drugs for the dealers out there as a mule.
Right.
And I got paid in drugs. That's how I was able to maintain my addiction. I would also steal, of course. I would boost Target and Walgreens and sell the stuff on the street. And so you do hustle when you're out there to survive.
Yep.
I got off the street because I started getting caught up, basically. And this is where I begin to diverge maybe from some folks when we talk about decriminalization and, you know, the need for law enforcement to play a role, not the only role, but to play a role in mitigating the drug crisis and the homeless crisis that we see out there. I was holding drugs for six different dealers at one point, and I had six gym socks in my coat. And the police were doing a sting on that block, and they had been surveilling me from the parking garage with binocs. And they start driving up the wrong way on a one-way street. You know things are bad, so everybody, of course, scatters. Yeah. I go around the corner. I think I'm getting away. Boom, an unmarked police car pulls up, and they get me. I've got 4.5 ounces of heroin on me. I got a lot of stuff on me, a lot of dope. I go to jail. I spend the night in jail. They release me the next morning on my own recognizance, no bail, back out into homelessness. And I went through that cycle 5 more times over a 3-month period until the 6th arrest. They basically said, you've caught too many cases too close together, can't let you out. And I ended up spending about 3 months in county jail, where I was given medically assisted treatment. I was given buprenorphine in jail to kick the withdrawals. And from there, I was presented with an opportunity to go to drug treatment because no one was still gonna take me back. My wife still had a restraining order on me. And the only place that would take me for free was the Salvation Army. They had a bed available. So I went because I had lost everything at that point. I'd lost control even over the little bit of heroin that I had in my hand sitting between two cars, smoking it off the foil, chasing the dragon. I'd even lost that.
Right.
So at that point, I had nothing to lose. I knew there was no way back to my family from the street. And I didn't want to be in jail anymore because jail sucks. And so I went to treatment, and it changed my life forever. Forever.
Well, first of all, I'm glad it worked. And we both know how many times it doesn't, and you have to go back or whatever. And I'm so happy it worked. Was there a moment when you knew that I don't want to be this way anymore?
Yeah. When I was in jail.
Yeah.
I have to be honest. So when I was on the street, when I would think about that or think about my kids, I would just use more to numb the pain. You know, really, honestly, I would just use more because I didn't want to feel the guilt or the shame. It's not even stigma, man. It's just the guilt and the shame that you screwed up and like you don't get to see your kids anymore.
Right.
Like that's not stigma. That's just like, damn, I screwed up and I don't get to see my kids anymore. I think it's important that people understand the difference. As society stigmatizes drug users, I know that that's a big issue right now of trying to destigmatize, but there's also some personal accountability in there where it's like, damn, I felt terrible that I had let my daughter down. She was 12 at the time. I let my son down. He was 9. That I hadn't seen them in a year plus. But it wasn't until I was in jail where I had been in jail for a while. I'd been in jail. I'd been arrested. You got to remember, I'd been in jail 5 times before that, either for, you know, 1 to 4 or 5 days. And then they'd let me out. But the last time I got arrested, they locked me up for about 90 days.
Right.
So it was maybe about 30 days into jail that I was like, man, I've really, truly lost everything. And I don't want this to be my life. And I think it was a day when I met with my public defender. He came to see me in jail talking about all the cases that I had. He was like, well, you know, we're going to try to get you on SSI, on Social Security. I said, what? He goes, yeah, well, you know, you're 48. You're pretty much retired already. See if we can get you onto disability or Social Security. And I was just like, I don't think I'm, my life isn't over yet. I'm 48. My life isn't over yet.
Yeah.
That was one inkling. Another inkling for some of you faith-based folks out there that might be interested in that perspective. There's a library in our pod in jail, and somebody had thrown a Bible in the garbage, and I just thought it was disrespectful, so I just picked the Bible out of the garbage.
Good.
Took it back to my cell. I had nothing else to do. I started reading it, and I still have that Bible. I still have it.
That's, God bless. That's beautiful.
You know, I know that's not for everyone. I'm not trying to say that's for everyone, but I think it speaks more to the fact that when you've lost all hope and you're feeling truly alone in the world, it's okay to think that maybe there's a higher power out there. And it doesn't have to be God. It can be a tree. It can be the universe. That there's a higher power out there that's looking out for you. Because that, in my moment of solace and loneliness and pain in jail, I actually found a little bit of hope in that.
Well, we both know somebody who wrote Junkie the Judge. You know, she's not a believer, but in that work for her, you know, and that's my point. There's not one fine line. There's different ways to get where they are. I happen to be a person of faith, but I understand those who don't. Right. I have a friend of mine who went through who was an atheist, not even an agnostic, who didn't believe, and they had a problem with the God situation. And somebody explained to him and said, why don't you try God as an acronym for good, orderly direction for your day? And that got him through, you know, so he was able to do that through the 12-step program that he went through, because he was alcohol. So he went strictly for that. But let's unpack a little bit more and kind of talk a little more just the society in a whole. Why do you think we have these camps? Harm reduction. Now, I was part of a harm reduction seminar that I loved and a big part of that I believed in. And then there's people that say, you know, throw those bastards in jail forever, you know. And I really am where you're talking about, sort of in that middle. You know, I'll give you a little bit about my family's background. My father was a New York City policeman for 20 years, then a U.S. Marshal. My brother, a New York City policeman. His son is a lieutenant. His other son's a lieutenant. Daughter-in-law is a cop. My point is, and we have addiction in our family as well. My point is, we've got to bring these two sides together. And I'm sorry if that sounds kumbaya, but it's true, because you have these people who, I'm sorry, it all comes down to this. It comes down to raising funds this way or that way. And yay, I'm right. And people are dying. Yeah. And how do you think we bridge this gap?
So I'm with you, Darren. You know, I get mad. I get frustrated. I was on another podcast recently where I was just like, I don't know if I even want to try to bridge the gap with orgs like the Drug Policy Alliance. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, we probably do have to find a way to bridge that gap. And it's not because I have any disdain personally. It's not personal. It's just like what I believe, my belief system around recovery doesn't seem to completely line up with their belief system around what to do with drugs. And so, but there is still some common ground amongst all these people. Like, you know, you hear a lot of people talk about on social media about how, you know, people that don't have access to medically assisted treatment tend to have higher rates of overdose than people that do and all those things. And I'm sitting here scratching my head going, you know, I'm not really sure. And I'm friends with a lot of Republicans too and everything, and the conservative abstinence only folks. I mean, look, in the state of California where I live, you can't be a licensed drug treatment facility without offering that.
Of course, yes. I lived there for almost 16 years. Yes, absolutely. Right.
So I'm kind of scratching my head going, well, you know, it's almost like a straw man argument that they're making.
It is.
Because I'm like, you know, I think we all understand now that fentanyl's kind of changed the game a little bit, and you can't really kick it cold turkey. And yes, buprenorphine, yes, methadone should be part of the solutions for that, along with, you know, Narcan to reverse overdoses and all that. I think the idea, though, that accountability isn't part of the cornerstones, isn't one of the cornerstones of recovery is wrong, though. I do. That's where there's diversion, and like there's a rush to like open supervised consumption sites, and they cite all this different data, but there's a rush to decriminalize drugs. I understand. I'm not saying I don't get it. I actually understand, because jail sucks. I get it. And jail, for a lot of people, it doesn't help. It just compounds the trauma for folks. I understand all of those things. But to make those changes in the absence of infrastructure is where I have a beef. Okay. Mm-hmm. Decriminalization, reducing penalties, what they did in Oregon with Measure 110, decriminalizing possession of drugs up to 3 grams. 3 grams of fentanyl is 30 pills. Yep. That's not, that's as much, that's a drug dealer.
You know, 100%. And that's 30, you know, that's possibly 30 plus deaths.
Right. And only now is some of the money trickling in to fund the supposed drug treatment that they were going to be offering as an alternative. So again, it's the lack of infrastructure. If you want to make all these changes, even if you want to have supervised consumption sites, let's build an entire continuum of care for people.
100%.
That starts from stabilization and ends with independent living. And in between that, you can insert detox, treatment, supervised consumption, transitional housing, recovery-based housing, independent living. Have all of those things available so long as you have an adequate supply of the entire continuum. If, for example, you open a bunch of detox beds, but you have no residential treatment, is that going to help anyone?
No.
They're going to get off the dope and go right back to the street, right?
I see it here. I was up in Plymouth not too long ago. You see it right there. I pulled it out. I was visiting the place and the deal was being made as I was pulling out.
Right. So it's the same argument that I make with supervised consumption. I'm actually neutral to those sites as an example. If you want to have supervised consumption sites, that's fine. But if you have them without the detox and the treatment and aftercare that's necessary for someone's journey through the recovery process, then you're opening one of these sites kind of in a vacuum. Mm-hmm. It's kind of my argument. And all you have to do is, and I know each city's different. So I know New York's having a little bit different results. But Vancouver is a great example. They have 14 supervised consumption sites in Vancouver, and they continue every month to break records for their overdose deaths. And it's because it takes weeks to get someone into a treatment bed.
And let me tell you something. I can give no names, but people trust me on this. Statistics from a municipality take with a grain of salt, because I know of a very large city that is supposedly open all night, quote unquote, so you might know the city, whose local precinct statistics were like this. Listen, Tom, no, I don't want you putting down rapes anymore as rapes. They are aggressive muggings, or they were you changed a couple of words and the statistics are different. Wow, rapes are way down. You know, yep. No, they weren't. They were characterized differently. I know that for a fact. You know, I use that example.
Right. That's a great example, Darren. It's really a great example. Nobody's died in a supervised consumption site. They generally shop that data around. Right. How many people died in the ambulance on the way to the hospital?
Of course. Absolutely. I mean, for me, and again, to you, let me ask you this. To you, this nebulous term, harm reduction, and again, I use the hashtag. To me, what does harm reduction mean to you before I tell you what I think it means?
So what it means to me is what I thought it used to mean kind of classically, was that the idea is to keep somebody alive long enough in the hopes that they find the miracle of recovery.
Yep. That's what I think. To me, it doesn't mean, you know, free drugs everywhere. I hand out a lot of Narcan. I still do. It means look at that as like having a fire extinguisher in your house. Just have it in your house just in case.
Yeah.
I'll give you a great positive. You know how right-leaning a city like Clovis, California could be. Mm-hmm. So just 3 years ago, during a Clovis days that we were having, I was had a stand and I was trying to give away 300 boxes of Narcan. And I got called all sorts of vile stuff. I was called everything of, I'm condoning drug use. What do you think? My kid is a drug addict. What are you trying to say? You know, those kind of things. 2 years ago, I did the same thing. 300 in less than a half a day.
Yeah.
And to me, that's positive harm reduction.
Yeah. That's where it can be positive, because we have to be honest, right? Like, look, I know a lot of parents who lost their kids to fentanyl poisoning, and mm-hmm. they call it poisoning, right? They bought what they thought was Xanax off of Snapchat, and it turns out to have fentanyl in it, and they die. So, you know, that's why Narcan is necessary. It's because this is the world that we're living in, whether we like it or not. Both of my kids carry Narcan in their backpacks to school every day.
So do mine. Yep.
Because that's the reality that we live in today. It doesn't mean we have to like it. It doesn't mean that we just accept the world as it is. That's why we fight for change and advocate. But at the same time, you got to be real about what's happening. Mm-hmm. You know, San Francisco this year alone, just in a 6-month period, the police pulled 76 kilos of fentanyl off the street. And that's probably 5 or 10% of what's actually out there.
Oh yeah, that's
it. So yep. We've got to be real about what's happening out there. I mean, it's an unmitigated crisis of epic proportions, worse than anything that we've ever faced before, and that's supported by the data, by the amount of overdose deaths that you see out there. It's worse than the crack era in many ways, because now our response to it hasn't been as bad as it was in the crack era. Our response was wrong in the crack era. We all admit that, but that doesn't mean that we should let the pendulum swing all the way to the other side, to this kind of permissiveness. And that's where I think harm reduction gets muddled.
I agree, 100%.
There's the definition of harm reduction as maybe you and I believe it, and then there's kind of this idea that harm reduction also means permissiveness, and underneath that is a goal to have it be legalized and the whole bit. And I just don't trust, private health insurance companies, private pharmaceutical. After what happened in the 90s with pain pills, I just don't trust them that they're going to legally do this the right way to give medication out for people.
They're not. I mean, I have my thoughts on, like, in my utopia, and I'm sorry for you, again, hard right people. It might seem a little socialist, scary, but, I'm a big believer in what happened to you is the success story. You go in, whether you're, you're busted for your fifth time, like you did too close together, plus other things, you're shoplifting, you're publicly urinating, you're harassing this public. You have healthcare professionals on staff at those facilities that say, hey, this is what's going on here. This is the way we diagnose Darren or Tom, and these are some options. You take some of these kids that are fresh out of medical school, who have these big student loans, and you pay them whatever prevailing wage is for that city, and they have to do 2 or 3 years, doing that. It's a start. At least it comes with something to help these people.
Yeah.
Or else we're just going to do this. I love San Francisco. I mean, my wife and my daughter love L.A. My daughter lives in L.A. I've always been a San Francisco guy. I love it. And it's still beautiful, but it's a shame what's going on there. It's an absolute shame. And people walk over, these are human beings, and it's just a mess that we allow this to happen.
Right.
My grandma used to say, because she lived in an old area of Brooklyn, it was all mobbed up. And she says, say what you want about these mobsters, but you'll never see these streets dirty or this or that. Or why? They took care of the streets.
Right.
Maybe not the right way, but,
They took care of the streets nonetheless. So this is the problem, is that, it's a really a philosophical issue about, like, how to solve homelessness, housing. Okay, we all agree that there's a housing crisis on the West Coast of the United States, and that more housing would help alleviate much of this problem. But at the same time, there's this deliberate downplaying of the drug and mental health crisis because there's an effort to destigmatize people's views around people who use drugs. The problem with that is that they're making a terrible mistake, because while the destigmatizing is good, downplaying the actual size and scope of the problem is really a mistake, because then budget dollars don't go to the right place to address the right things. Right. And that's already been kind of put in place and almost like codified into law in California, that pretty much most of the money that we're spending now is just on housing for home. When they talk about services for the homeless, it's creating, either converting old motels into some kind of housing or trying to build new housing along the way. And we're never going to build enough of it fast enough to house 191,000 people that are experiencing homelessness right now. So at the same time, they've defunded the shelter system a great deal. They've not funded treatment in any meaningful kind of way, nationally, not just at a state level, but nationally. I can't think of any state that I visited that actually has enough drug treatment for their needs. They can't recruit enough people to work in that field because they don't pay them well enough. There's a lot of different things going on there. And politicians, they kind of start leaning one way, but then they always kind of go back to the other thing about, well, we're just kind of committed to housing because there's all these studies that say, well, really housing reduces homelessness. But guess what? When you're homeless for 5 years, living in a tent on the street, and you're in injecting substances into your body every single day, and you're living on general relief or general assistance to get you to, and then maybe the occasional shoplifting to get you through your day. And you take someone in that condition and place them into low barrier housing with no preconditions. You're actually starting to see the results of that now in San Francisco. This year, 69% of all of our overdose deaths in the city, and we have almost 800, happened inside at a fixed address. And the majority of those happened inside permanent supportive housing. So I think it's really important that we understand how fentanyl has complicated the way we respond to homelessness. And I challenge all the folks out there, the harm reduction folks listening, everything, to really think about that. It's like they say, well, we should put safe injection sites inside SROs. Look, we're at least 3 years, if not 4 years, away from the federal government making a decision about the crack house statute. Right. So the city and county of San Francisco has already decided that they're not going to open one of these sites right now because they're afraid of getting sued. Mm-hmm. Right. So we have to think of realistic solutions. So they're like, well, we should put naloxone on every floor. We already do that.
We do that now. I mean,
how do you Narcan yourself when you're alone in your room using?
By the way, people, seriously, you can't.
Can't.
You can't.
And then the people will say, well, you know, if we had a safe injection site, that person would still be alive. What? You're going to leave the privacy of your own home?
It's cold out.
To walk four blocks to go use
safe consumption? It's raining. It's cold out. It's good show on. You know, right.
We just have to be honest, and that's not a dig on safe injection sites. You just got to be realistic about what's actually happening, right?
For me, if you're going to do safe injection sites, and I understand the plausibility of them, I want to attach them to, again, sorry if people, if this sounds whatever, but I want to attach them to a facility where you want to shoot up. Okay, great. We're going to check you real quick to make sure that you're healthy, you're okay, you're healthy enough to leave. You know, I don't want you getting into hurting anybody, you know.
So you know, they do that in Canada, some places, not all places. You know, look, most safe injection sites in Vancouver is you walk in, you tell them your name. It can be any name. It could be John Doe. Right.
John Doe.
Yep. You write it down on a piece of paper, and then you go in and, you know, they give you some food maybe, and then you can sit down and shoot your dope, right? Got it. Some places in Canada, you actually have to go in and swipe your medical card because they have universal health care in Canada, and your whole medical history comes up so that they know who you are. They know what kind of drugs interact with the drugs you're about to use. They know if you have any other co-occurring disorders or comorbidities along the way. And then once that's all been identified and maybe a little bit of triage is done, you can go use your drugs. That makes a lot more sense to me.
That's where I sit with those places.
Right. But of course, people will say, well, no, you're stigmatizing. They're never going to agree. I'm like, you know, if someone wants to use that bad, they'll go and do it if they want to use that bad in a safe place, because they're sure as hell going to go out to the doorway and shoot dope out there.
That's right. I think that the person who doesn't like that, in my opinion, is a zealot. I'm not totally dismissing them, but I can't go down that road. Here's why. Because there's nobody who wants to die. They may say they want to die, very few people. And if you do want to die, there's other issues we have to worry about. You're giving them at least a understanding of health. And I believe in Professor Cialdini from Arizona State wrote this wonderful book on the law of reciprocity. And, you're going to let me shoot up here? Okay, yes. You can check my health. Thank you very much. You feel that there's a causality there. You're just not sitting in a flop house getting, you know, God knows what's going to happen.
Right.
So I like that. I wanted to ask you before we go, because I really appreciate your time. Did you ever see the movie Body Brokers?
I have not.
If you get a chance, I want you to see it. Just because we can talk about it privately or whatever. What is your feeling about some of these rehab centers?
You know, everybody wants to do the right thing, mostly. I know about body brokering that was happening in Florida. I understand all of that happened down there, and people using rehab for profit. And I always kind of scratch my head because I'm like, you know, I've been an advocate now for 4 years advocating for solutions to the drug crisis and homelessness. There's no money in this, man. Not for me anyway. And I'm not looking for it either. So I think that that's a shameful practice. But I think for the old school rehabs that are abstinence based, they need to come into the 21st century.
Agreed.
And start offering medically assisted treatment across the board to everyone.
That's what I said.
In states that don't require it, like a lot of the rural, more southern states, Midwest, they don't require it. I think rescue missions need to change up maybe their shelter systems and make them more appealing, so they're not the military style bunks, and have them be kind of semi congregate spaces where there's a little more spacing for people, and then offer connections to services that include and start with detoxification, right? I think it's important because when laws changed in 2015, 2016 in California, a lot of those old school rehabs and detoxes, like the Ozanon detox and some of these smaller rescue missions up in Northern California, like they lost funding or they shut down. And regardless of how you feel about that, the God thing and all that, those were a net loss of beds.
Exactly.
That's my big thing, is that we need all the beds. So, you know, we need all the newer kind of harm reduction based stuff and the abstinence based stuff, and we need it all to come together, but you need to bring the old school into the 21st century, and you have to ask kind of the more radicalized folks out there that are practicing harm reduction that you have to, I'm just asking them to listen to what it is that I'm trying to say, and have the pendulum kind of land a little bit in the middle, because right now it's swung too far in one direction and deaths aren't decreasing.
Nope.
You know, you might feel better about it, right? Because you're granting people their civil liberties and body autonomy, but they're still dying.
Yeah, that's still not good. You know, not the same thing. But before I let you go, one other thing we're doing is, besides handing out the Narcan, is going to a lot of campuses. People don't even know that fentanyl testing strips are available in California as well.
Yeah,
and my God, you put that drink down. Why not? Just test that drink. You know, just test that drink. There's so many things. Again, back to me, that's what harm reduction is. You know, that is. But before I let you go, if somebody wants to learn more about you and the work that you do, and I want to thank you so much from my heart, what you do, because you're making a difference, whether you believe it or not. How can somebody find more about you?
So the crux of my platform right now is on Twitter, X. Regardless how you feel about that, you should come take a look at the stuff that I say. Some of it is controversial, but most of it is, the focus is on recovery, on solutions to finding more recovery options for people. My handle is @TWolfRecovery. You can also find out more about me on my website. You go to www.gooddrugpolicy.org/paper, P-A-P-R. That's for my nonprofit. I have a bio in there. And that's how you can also.
Yeah, send that link to me. I want to put that link out, please. Yeah. And I don't know if you ever on TikTok, my suggestion is go there. Your message will be heard.
Okay.
All right. Be well, my friend.
Okay, Darren, take care of yourself, man.
Thank you.
Bye. Okay. Bye.